It's Jim Cramer here. You're listening to the opening bell of CNBC's Squawk on the Street. Don't miss a minute of the action.
Good Friday morning. Welcome to Squawk on the Street. I'm Carl Quintanilla with Jim Cramer, David Faber at the New York Stock Exchange. Futures are up, but the S&P nevertheless may well snap a five-week win streak. Bond market reopens. The curve flattens further. Dollar strength means that oil is down week to date, and gasoline futures are at a six-week low. Our roadmap begins with J&J, though, splitting as the company announces plans to spin off its consumer health business.
Plus, it has been a big week for EVs. Shares of Rivian, well, they continue to rally, and charging company stocks are getting a big boost from Biden's infrastructure bill.
And poking fun at the metaverse, Iceland, with this new tourism ad that you will not want to miss. We'll start, though, with J&J, announcing plans to split into two companies, the pharma and a medical device company, which will be called Johnson & Johnson, and then the Tylenol Listerine Band-Aid company. Revenue about $15 billion, but a name we still don't have, Jim.
Yeah, look, I think this is really great because one of the things that people may not realize is J&J is a pharmaceutical giant, and they're also one of the fastest growing pharmaceutical companies. They have, if you compare them to almost anyone in the business, if you compare them to Pfizer, you compare them to Bristol Myers, GlaxoSmithKline, I think you'd be amazed at how fast they're, the business that will get the highest multiple will grow. I mean, double-digit grow, organic.
No, I wonder that you bring up multiple, and let's get to that discussion in terms of the stock market and whether and how you add value here, because J&J trades at a higher multiple overall than most pharma companies.
Yes.
Because consumer products gets a higher multiple, even though it's not a growth business. You've pointed out many times, P&G trades at, what, 25 times?
Yes, but in
and
this...
And so when you split this thing, is what's going to be left going to be a lower multiple than what it currently gets right now?
Okay, so there are some people who do breakups who have just said that to me. Jim, be careful saying that, look, this is necessarily going to go much higher. I come back and think about Abbott, okay? So Abbott splits. Abbott has a decent drug business, okay? And they've got a very good device business, nutrition, which they've kept. And if you think about this, this is the great Miles White. Abbott-AbbVie separation, this is the AbbVie being the stuff that would be like the consumer product, okay? And to some degree, it's a little higher level.
Right.
But Abbott-AbbVie separation at more than $431 billion today, okay, it was $81 billion when they did the separation, and that was in 2030. That's 10 years. It's one of the greatest cap. It's really may be exhibit A about why you should do this. And I think that Miles White is an amazing, amazing executive, but I think Alex Gorsky is an incredible executive.
Well, Miles White certainly created a lot of value, and we do know that splits, and we've been talking and kidding about shrink to grow for a decade now.
Laser focused.
Yeah. Laser focused, exactly. All those words that bankers use to talk to management about what they should be thinking about. But that's the story in the market. I mean, it's 1 week and we've seen two iconic companies, Carl,
incredible,
choose to go down this road of splitting up because of focus, because of both on the customer level and the consumer level and in the marketplace itself. They continue to say as well that, you know, there was a growing divergence between these businesses, even more so as a result of COVID in part. But well, there was once a day when prescriptions went to OTC and you could sort of see some overlap there. But
look,
happen.
They've got what I regard as I call football brands in the store, meaning that you could have a knockoff that looks just like them from Walgreens that people will buy because it's cheaper. I mean, when you go to the cornstarch baby powder, well, there's like a lot of cornstarch baby powder.
Yeah.
So
we're not even mentioning GE, but we're not mentioning what Pfizer's already done or what Merck's done or what Raytheon's done. And more reports today about what Toshiba may do.
I know. Gluten-3. That's interesting. That's under pressure. How about GlaxoSmithKline? Under pressure right now, of course, right from, these guys are tough. You know that.
That's Elliot, right?
Yeah,
they're tough.
Under pressure
they're tough.
By Elliot.
Yeah.
And one of the things that you've interviewed Elliot. One of the things that I think is really interesting is they've split that company into two. I don't know if you can see this, and the performance has been pretty good versus how if you take a longer term view. But Elliot's not happy. They think there's a lot more there. And
right. At
they
Glaxo.
Believe that the consumer business, which is merging with Pfizer, could be worth a lot more.
Mm-hmm.
And their rigor when they come in. Paul Singer's rigor?
Well, yeah, they've got a big team there on the
activist
front.
I think if you just
but what's your point here? Why are you bringing up Glaxo, though, in relation to J&J?
Glaxo was saying over and over again, Walmsley was saying, Damon Mars was saying, listen, people do not see the great growth we have in our pharma. The only way to call attention to it is to get rid of the slower growth products.
Right.
And J&J, to some degree, the slower growth products have hurt them. I mean, plus,
I know, but it's funny because the slower growth business still gets a higher multiple.
Well,
than...
and this one's not clear because, you know, when you have 10% organic growth for a drug company, you got some excitement in every division.
True. By the way, this is all, just like GE, going to take quite some time. I mean, they're talking 18 to 24 months.
Yeah.
They don't have a name as of yet. Obviously, the management team at the consumer products company is in place. But, you know, and Gorski's going to be stepping down as CEO early next year, becoming chairman of overall J&J.
But why do you think they gave medical
device? So similar to GE, I mean, we're talking, you know, it'll be 2 years before when we're sitting here and these companies will actually have
medical device has been bad because of COVID. That can snap back. Let's not forget that the talc litigation is with consumer product.
Right.
And the talc litigation has been horrendous. They have opioid legislation. Look, it's not all done in fair weather, J&J.
No.
But they have a great cancer franchise that people don't talk about enough. I think they do a lot of good, you know, they have a lot of good drugs.
Right. But then it'll be, the peer group will be with, you know, Merck and Pfizer and all the ones that we still talk about it with, but obviously it will be a pure play.
Yes.
Right?
And, you know, look.
And then the consumer products will be what? Go Nestle and P&G? Or what do you, Colgate? Where do you kind of put it?
Yeah, I saw Colgate the other night, and Colgate's such a long-term winner, just consistent winner. And I just think that in the end, you should try to merge it with one of those companies.
You do?
Yeah, I do.
Funny, because there has always been speculation of a merge spin of some kind of this business with Colgate. That's not, I don't think, in the cards at this point, but... You know, this will be a business, again, Carl, that can issue stock, that can start to consolidate as well, which is another reason why you get these announcements.
Well, it's, and, of course, the banks are loving this. I don't know if you saw the FT piece earlier in the week that GE has spent $7 billion in IB fees over the past 21 years, more than any other U.S. company.
People should know that Goldman is involved with Rivian.
I know the recipients of a lot of those fees from GE, all the things they sold and bought and sold and bought. And pick, it's... The bankers always figure out a way, right?
Right. Well, I think that in the when I was growing up, you knew that you would go to Goldman and you'd make a lot of money. Now the same people say, you know what? Facebook's got a great New York office. By the way, the people who apply for Facebook, they don't hate Mark Zuckerberg, and they may not like the Iceland video.
So you don't believe the whole recruitment issue that they come that is a stigma to interviewing there or going to work there.
I know enough people to know that the stigma is false, that they kill for the, remember the seven-stage interview, anytime you can drop out.
So your point is that younger people today are still gravitating towards those names as opposed to Goldman Sachs,
now, I think Goldman,
J.P. Morgan, Morgan Stanley.
Well, I mean, look, I think that the...
Really?
The, yes.
Okay.
Yes. I mean, I got out of school, and I didn't have the skill. You need computer science skills or an engineer skill. We could put up NVIDIA. You know, it's an engineering heaven. But if you come out and you have a legal or obviously business, and you go to Goldman, you have a pretty great life now because I think that Solomon Wood, how many days you got to work there?
I used to got to work pretty hard.
If
you're young, 80 to 100 hours a week is still what you're putting
in. I used to teach on Friday nights.
You're one of the younger.
When I was at Goldman, I would teach 11 and give an exam at 11. And then, of course, post the bottom five on Monday right on the so everybody could see.
By the way, pay is also going up at these firms, and not just Goldman, but also many of the others and the boutiques.
But,
I mean, right out of college, $300,000 a year or more. It's a pretty big number, Jim.
For a 22-year-old.
Yeah.
Yes, it is.
25, well, maybe.
Look,
not even.
People.
No, I mean, you're right. 23 years
no,
old.
No, I remember when I was at college, there was a line out, you know, line down all the way to Harvard Square to see Credit Suisse because people just were, I mean, the same people who were telling you that they were, you know, United the People will never be defeated, United the People at Credit Suisse would never be poor.
Well, the story on the wires yesterday about how CS is making a big push to recruit, having to make up for the huge exodus.
They have to. They lost a lot of
people. Did you ever try
Credit
Suisse?
As a result of the Archegos blow up.
I tried to get a job at Credit Suisse. It was going really, really well. And then Goldman called me and said, basically, yeah, if you have another meeting with them, I think they knew I was like Big Brother. It was like China. You have another meeting with them.
Oh, exploding offer kind of?
Yeah.
Nice.
And they told me, listen, you've got about 24 hours, and 12 of them have already been used.
So you did, and here
you
are.
I sure did, and I was so excited. I walked out. It was a cold day. I put on my raincoat. I got right to the airport to be able to go, and I realized that I had a partner's raincoat, and I had to try to get back so that the partner.
I mean, you picked up somebody else's raincoat.
You know, it was a partner, and had a lot of important stuff in the pockets.
Well,
I realized my career was over before it started.
You still work 80 to 100 hours a week.
I was up at 3:30 today. Yeah. It was a good day to be up at 3:30. I didn't know. Right at that very moment, there was really nothing other than Sundial reporting a good quarter.
Well, we do have a lot of news. Of course, there's Rivian, big start as a public company. Elon Musk taunting them on Twitter. Got a downgrade today of Ride. We'll talk more about the EV space. Take a look at the futures. Jim mentions NVIDIA, downgrade from Wedbush.
Well, that was just...
I save it because I can't wait to hear what you think about this one.
I hope that guy loses in fantasy this weekend.
There's a look at futures. We're back in a moment. Rivian aiming for a third straight session of gains since the public debut on Wednesday. Market cap is now above $100 billion as we approach the end of a big week for the EV space. Jim, you had long said that you thought this would come in hot to market.
Yeah, this is just a great one. And when I spoke to the Amazon sustainability officer at an ESG conference I ran, they have no choice. They literally need every Rivian vehicle. And when you hear that, all you can say is, well, then where are the sellers? You know, if that 20% seller is not going to sell, what's going to happen? I want to know whether Ford is going to go to try to get a release to be able to sell the stock. But I don't think that's the way they're headed, David. But this is the day usually where you're wrong to come in and buy it. These institutions wanted to finish their buy by the end of the week. They all seem to be full up. And the people who are buying it now are anticipating that that same level of buying is going to come in. Don't really understand. I think that what you have is...
That's just stunning, though, isn't it?
Well, but the institutions all want a full position because, as you said, institutions were not flippers.
I pointed
that was
out.
One of the best price...
On
they
Wednesday,
should study that.
When I told you, it was sovereign funds. It was buyers. The initial book for the IPO was very incredibly solid to the point where you weren't going to get flippers.
Amazing.
These were long-term holders. RJ Scaringe...
Yep.
Oversaw the allocation. And so that went extraordinarily
well.
But
you've told that. That's so unusual.
Yesterday we had an analyst out. I'm like, how do you value this thing? It's like, well, maybe on 23 revenues. $8 billion in 23 revenues. And so, all right.
Well, I think Elon Musk told you how to value, right? Which is that they're able to achieve high production, break-even cash flow. True test, and I don't know whether they can do either, but I do think that they have the orders to do it.
This was in response to a Twitter user last night, just making the point that there have been hundreds of startups in the car business over the last century, and that Tesla's been able to produce a lot of cars and get some positive cash flow. Very hard to do.
Look, I know Ford. I think Ford has a Get Musk division.
By the way, everything... he said there is probably true, which sometimes
true.
With his tweets, you never know.
No, it is true.
I mean, everything he said there is
true. It was a very, very commonsensical tweet.
Yes.
But then again, Musk sold another 639,000 shares yesterday. Now, you could say it doesn't matter, but he has to pay taxes, too.
He's going
to
keep selling.
That's my point.
But what wasn't true was that Twitter poll where he was making it seem as though he was going to make a decision
based on a North Korean election run by...
As Robert Frank and others have pointed out, he's got to sell. He's got to sell to pay the taxes on this huge option position that he has that he's going to be converting to stock.
I'm sure there are people out there who are wealthier saying, and he almost had nothing left.
What do you mean?
The government confiscated so much money from him.
It is a nice little windfall for the government, $15 billion potentially.
Well, Abigail Disney, who's been very critical of billionaires and wealth, said, look, I'll be glad to have the government take that money.
Yeah. I like that. And it can go towards EV and charging.
Well, that's what Ford
the whole plan.
How about Ford selling its stake and building the biggest battery factory? Wouldn't that be terrific?
Yes.
Now, one of the things that Musk has been dead right about is the companies that compete are all internal combustion engine companies that they're trying to do EV. And they're not EV native. Ford could divide into two companies. They could divide in traditional, and they could do EV native, and the stock be at 30 right now.
You think that's likely? We were just talking about a split of high growth and steady growth companies.
No, it's not, and I think it would be financial engineering. There's a great American, Jeff Bukas, whom I approached to do something like that. He said, that's good. That's give you about a 5-minute pop.
Yeah. No, it's true.
Dukas was something.
Yes.
He was something.
He did a good job.
He did a really good job.
Getting out.
Yeah.
And
he told you how. He's a little musky.
A lot of these companies, you do need to have, when you take over sort of a slow growth company in an industry, you need to have a longer term vision as to how you're going to go about exiting and putting it all together for the ultimate exit. Bukas did a good job of that.
To your point, though, about Rivian, there is an item on the tape this morning that they're seeking a U.S. facility for a battery plant. So we will look for that directional investment in this country, right?
Battery's the gateway. That's the gated area.
Right.
That's going to be the hardest. The materials are very hard. But we have people every day in our business who just do nothing but buy anything that's lithium.
Right.
I mean, you could have
a gating issue for them, though, is capital. They raised $11.5 billion of it.
That's so why Ford needs it.
And they are, by the way, going to be in a position to sell stock, it would seem, as Tesla did along the way, because he is also an incredible promoter, as well as so many other things, Mr. Musk. And that enabled them to get to that cash flow positive. You've got to have access to capital to get there. Rivian certainly seems to have a good amount of it for now.
Well, I think that we also have to applaud Musk. He didn't really have the semiconductor problems that everybody has. Everybody's got.
Yeah, more recently. I'm just talking over the
long run. No, I'm saying Musk is
for the development of the company.
Look, Musk is for real. I think the stock price is high, but for real, because he is a part of the solution. I mean, we have all these conferences, one going on in Singapore now. We had the one in Glasgow.
Right,
what are they about?
They're
about
Rivian stay as a $100 billion+ company, market cap company for the foreseeable future.
I think so.
You do.
Well, this is not Warby Parker.
Okay. Nobody said it was.
Well, no, but Warby Parker reported they doubled the loss, size of the loss, and it was suboptimal.
Yeah. The cars are a little more complex.
Yes. Then glasses. Yes, absolutely. Direct to consumer.
We do have some more encouraging news from Toyota this morning about the chip shortage. We'll talk about that as they get back to normal production for the first time in about 7 months. We'll get Cramer's Mad Dash. We'll count down to the opening bell as futures look to end on a good note, although the S&P is still looking at a weekly loss. Don't go away.
All right, 8 minutes to go before we get started with the final trading session of the week, because it's Friday, Jim.
Yes.
Yes.
And I will not poo-poo this downgrade.
Okay. Mad Dash, you're talking about a downgrade of...
Wedbush downgrades one of my absolute favorite stocks, NVIDIA. And
yes.
I'll be visiting NVIDIA next week. They're basically saying they can't justify this incredible move and that they will not pay the price 100% since May. They will not pay the price. I'll use the language that they use. Net, while we remain very bullish on both NVIDIA's near-term prospects and longer-term, we simply find ourselves unable to justify lifting our multiple price earnings multiple to pay these prices. Now, I think if you like the stock all the way, you can do a victory lap. I'm going to pay attention to what this guy said. A lot of people felt that I'd slag him. No. I think, you know what? That's a good run. Matt Bryson did a good job.
All right. Well, this has been an extraordinary run right here. A lot of this due to excitement, I would argue, over the metaverse.
AI.
They don't call it the metaverse at NVIDIA.
They don't.
You've taught us a lot about what Mr.
Well, he is
Jensen
your digital twin.
Believes will be coming.
Right. And we're going to look at a bit of an Icelandic spoof of the digital twin later on. Yeah. It was fantastic tweet. Here's what I think. This company has more opportunity in many different divisions, and that you... sell it and then try to get back in, and it's just too cute. Like, look, you could sell it here, and maybe it goes to here. Are you going to get back in right there? It's too hard. That'll be a couple days where it's really down. There'll be people dumping on it. They'll come on and say, well, the best days are behind it.
Right.
And I just find that that's a game. I talk about this a lot with my club, the investment club. That's a game I can't play.
Well, listen, and to your credit on this name, because you get a lot of heat on others.
Yes, I
do. You have been an incredible proponent of this stock and company for many years.
It's
and
because of the time.
If we have a second, I hear the music playing, just to look back 5 years or 10 years. That is, to your
and
point,
let's not
the
forget
way
they have
that
an amazing
you...
CFO, Colette Kress. He would be so mad at me right now. He would say, do you not know it's my team? Do you not know it's my team? Why do you talk about me? And he's everything that you want in America. He's just a great... Yeah, I know. He's brilliant and he's humble. He's the opposite of Musk.
All right.
We're both brilliant.
We got an opening bell coming up in just a few minutes. And remember, You can catch us anytime, anywhere. Listen to and follow the Squawk on the Street Opening Bell podcast. We're back after this.
What do we call this not-so-new chapter in human connectivity? The Iceland Worse. Enhanced, actual reality without silly-looking headsets. In our open-world experience, everything is real. And has been for millions of years.
That's a new tourism ad out of Iceland. It's gone viral around the world, taking a swipe at the metaverse and Mark Zuckerberg. It's easy to forget that the whole world is aware of this whole move.
Absolutely. Look, it's one of those things where he's in the water at one point, this fellow, with someone and says, oh, you're a person.
Are you a human?
Are you a human? And there is a fantastic scene in the actual Zuckerberg, Blockbuster.
Video
Zuckerberg's
presentation.
Surfing,
yeah,
with someone else, and I think it's a great scene. But now, I mean, there you go. I mean, he's mocking them by talking about whether the other person's real. They are the way that you should do this. By the way, if you're going to do it, is different from Mark. You have to do it with an avatar that looks not like a cartoon avatar that you did on Adobe. Adobe's programs that are very good. You have to use what Jensen has, which is that you're not able to tell whether it's whether it's you or it's a little frightening.
Yeah,
you can't tell.
You think the cartoon element is not enough?
No, if I want my wife to be playing Rummy Cube with me, I don't want a cartoon of my wife. I want the real deal.
Can't you just play with her in real life, though? No?
No, because she's going to live in Delray for a while.
Oh, so you guys can get together in the metaverse. But
yeah, because I don't like the texting.
But you can't touch each other, can you, in the metaverse?
None of your business, son of a...
That's awfully personal. There's the opening bell and the CNBC real-time exchange. At the big board, it's Robert F. Smith, a Vista Equity Partners CEO and philanthropist, celebrating One Stock, One Future. It's a goal-setter initiative to create 1 million Black and Latinx youth shareholders nationwide. At the NASDAQ, Loyalty Ventures, a rewards programs provider, celebrating its spinoff from Alliance Data.
Well, spinoff. Alliance Data used to be a hot stock at one point. I am so possessed by this J&J breakup because I want it to be the next Abbott because it is a great American company. But I also want the pearls are demonstrated by Dame Walmsley, which is that if you don't have the pharma growth or people are suspicious of it, well, then people don't want that pure play. I think it's amazing how everyone assumes they have a great pharma franchise. Johnson & Johnson does.
Johnson, J&J is going to help lead the S&P this morning, along with some other biopharma names. There's Biogen up there as well.
Well, Biogen was interesting because another proof of concept. Remember, Biogen's Alzheimer's drug. Okay, anytime you ever see anything Biogen, it's Alzheimer's drug. And my problem with the Alzheimer's drug is, of course, the cost and whether the insurance companies
will pay it. And the efficacy is the key. It's not, nobody would care about the costs if it actually did some big things for treating Alzheimer's. The question is that big enough? Does it really move?
The work I do with various brain
disease
foundations leads us to be skeptical about Biogen because you've got to start it so much earlier and it's not necessarily going to work. The community of doctors who are involved with brains are dedicated to the proposition that there are certain Alzheimer's that are just horrendous that we got to work on, and we're just not getting the work. I don't mean to sound like we, meaning I'm like a doctor, but I do a lot of enough people. I always ask these guys when I do the foundational work, what do you think? And they just don't think there's a lot here.
Yep.
And it show. I mean, it's funny because that chart is a perfect reflection of sentiment, which shot up on the prospects for this incredible breakthrough drug treating this insidious disease that is so widespread, and then slowly but surely coming down as people say, well, maybe it's not as effective. Maybe the FDA really erred here and not listening to their
Well, that's
advisors,
when you ask me what the foundation
and maybe
people
the insurance companies will say, right. Why are we going to pay or why are we going to cover it?
I'm so glad you brought it. The panel that looked into this all didn't think it worked.
Right.
And the panel's made up of people like the people that I work with. And they're to go against them is daunting, given how much they know and what they're trying to do and how tremendously involved they are in the day-to-day saving of people's lives. And this thing comes out, and they're like, are you kidding me? Are you kidding me? This isn't what we need. So let's watch.
Speaking of the FDA, guys, just mRNA, I think, is worth taking a quick look at. It's up today, but, man, it has been in free fall.
Yes, it has.
Jim, had their conference call. I don't know that they took that many questions from what I understand. It doesn't look, I mean, given the performance in the stock, but when you come, yeah, I mean, you can see. I mean, the stock was in the mid-400s.
Well, there was the quarter, and now there's this dispute with the NIH over,
exactly,
over
yes,
patents. By the way, AP this morning says that the president, according to sources, will pick Dr. Robert Califf to lead the FDA. Long-time hunt for that. But, man, would you put this on the list of worst prints for Q3?
Wow. I don't know what to say. I mean, this was one of those companies where you have to look at their pipeline and their cancer pipeline. The modern day personalized cancer is worth a great deal.
Yes.
But you are up against this. The issue here is when you look at their market cap versus all the others. I mean, how long does this last? Now, go back to Pfizer. When Pfizer was in the 30s, there were people who thought that their idea that you needed a booster was phony, and it was just profiteering on the part of Pfizer. And the stock started rolling over. As you can see, it started rolling over. Then people started talking about the patent cliff and how 23 is going to be a disaster for Pfizer. And the company was telling me, look, you know, the booster, you're going to want the booster. And yes, we're all clamoring for the boosters, and Pfizer is going to be solving its patent cliff. They took a big stake in a company I like called Biohaven the other day, which is a company, there's 30 million migraine sufferers in this country. That's going to be owned by Biohaven, but worldwide it's just tremendous. Pfizer is accumulating a series of positions that are going to take this money and make it so that the patent cliffs are not going to be big. They're a very well-run financial company.
It's been a very good year for Pfizer, and obviously they're selling tens of billions of dollars worth of vaccine.
They did a great job. Now, people say, well, it's BioNTech.
By the way, Moderna did also.
Well, Ben
sells for real.
In
terms of developing a vaccine that is
effective. I don't know how you value it now if they don't have
Moderna? You don't know how you
value it. I don't know how, because I don't know what they have in the pipe. Are they going to be able to have these personalized cancer vaccines ready?
I don't know.
I think
and then
so.
There's, and then Carl raises the point, the questions. They're not taking a lot of questions on these patent questions.
And that's disturbing to people. I think people should look. Someone asked me the other day, is it time to sell Moderna? And I said, well, obviously you could say the time to sell Moderna. You can be a wise ass and say it was 400. But the answer is that you should sell some Moderna because we just don't know whether it's going to have the legs that Pfizer has. And David, how many times did you report to the market cap of Moderna?
Well, there was a period where Moderna's market cap was approaching that of Merck's. They were neck and neck. And now to just put it in perspective, Merck is more than twice the size now. And that happened very quickly.
Right. Moderna has one great drug, obviously. But we do know, Carl, that the mRNA, that template works. I was listening to a doctor the other night who runs a major cancer hospital in New York, who was saying, look, we now know that mRNA is the future, and Ben sells the future. He's very smart. And when he comes on, you know, I feel badly about what happened in the meeting, because when he comes on with Meg Terrell, who's so fabulous.
Yes.
Who, Ben Sell?
Yeah. I think he's good.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
He's no Borla. I mean, Borla is like this great figure, but Borla is really, some people say, Jim, it's really BioNTech. Are you giving Borla the credit?
We'll give a lot of credit wherever it might be.
Yeah?
Sure, why not?
Okay.
Speaking of market cap comparisons, guys, I'm keeping an eye on Disney and Netflix. No rebound in Disney today.
All right, let's talk about Disney.
They're about $4 billion apart, and I just, again, it's just sort of something to keep in mind.
No, I just was going to talk about Disney because
okay,
you were talking about Disney.
Talk about Disney. Go ahead.
Okay.
I'm not stopping you from talking.
So the problems with Disney, every division has lost a little more. They only have $2 million, okay, for Disney Plus. And, David, are you going to be drawn to the $1.99 for 1 month kind of free-for-all for Disney?
No. I'm paying for Disney Plus. I think I'm paying for Hulu. I'm paying for ESPN Plus.
I don't know what else I'm paying for.
I'm paying for Amazon. I'm paying for Netflix.
I don't think we're alone.
I think I'm paying for Paramount Plus in some way.
Really?
Paramount Plus?
I needed to get CBS at the other.
I'm paying for Redbox. I needed to watch football game.
Yeah. It was like $60 for the year, but you don't get the movie. I don't know. I don't even know what I get there.
You pay for Rabbit Ears?
You ever watch Peacock?
Of course, yes.
Content division
good
down.
Good answer, Carl.
The division content was cost too much. I mean, look, Jungle Cruise, does it save things? There's nothing short-term that will make Disney go higher. When Chapel Trust owns it, I've been wearing the hair suit of Disney. I mean, I got involved in the 170s. I thought that they were going to turn it. This is not a turn. But, David, the metaverse... I did that for you.
The metaverse, yeah.
Which no, gambling.
Talking about the metaverse.
Gambling is going to
you
be
want to listen. You want a CEO's focused on years out, and he certainly
he's
seems to be in the opportunity that they see in terms of the digital and real world.
When I talk to people about Disney, they can't believe that the stock has fallen this much, and they finally want to come in. The institutions, obviously, are looking at the next quarter, and the next quarter is going to be hard. The next quarter is hard. It will not be good. We may be the 12th quarter, maybe not. But and then some people are saying, well, Chapek, he's too pie in the sky about metaverse and gambling.
Right.
Are you one of those?
No, I'm not.
You're not?
No. A quick diversion for me into the world of luxury, guys. Not
of
names
what?
We talk about too often. The world of luxury. You ever go on Farfetch? Buy your wife a gift, maybe, or something like that?
No.
Or YNAB. You know, these luxury platforms.
I bought my wife a Black & Decker saw.
That's very romantic. That is very romantic.
Okay, I also got the drill.
Oh, wow.
So a drill to go
you
with
bought
the
those for her.
Yeah, she's very handy.
Well, if you ever wanted to get her a more romantic gift, you might want to go on one of these platforms. I mentioned them because
Farfetch
are up, and Richemont is the owner of YNAB, and they had a very long call, and they confirmed what a lot of people at least had thought might be the case, which is that they've been talking to Farfetch about a potential deal. There's Richemont up. In terms, from what my understanding is, and again, these things can change, but they're getting close to the end here in terms of their talk, where Farfetch would perhaps own as much as 25% of YNAB. They would pay for that with their own stock price. But what it also would be is, again, creating a neutral industry-wide platform in which Farfetch would invest directly in YNAB as a minority holder, and then YNAB would leverage Farfetch's platform solutions to support its transition to a hybrid model. And Farfetch is actually the biggest beneficiary of this potential news, but I don't talk about them too often. It's Cartier. You own Cartier and a lot of other, Van Cleef, a lot of other very high-end brands.
You know, the secret of
Richemont? And they have been under some pressure to do something with YNAB, which has been a money loser.
The secret of Richemont, why they're doing so well.
What is the secret?
Well, in PRC, it's very difficult to show how wealthy you are, but it's often thought that Richemont is a watch to demonstrate your wealth. You know the how much this costs.
Right.
That's actually from someone who's close to the company.
And these are, right, I mean, as you well know, these luxury companies rely heavily on the Chinese market.
Right.
We've talked about it. There's a reason why Arnaud, for a brief period, was the wealthiest man in the world at LVMH.
Yes.
Now, he's not anymore. Musk is, but he's still up there.
Well, I saw him with the phalanx of seven people, and I wanted to go up to him. And then I realized that I'll probably be tackled by one of his guards.
Musk, that is?
Arnaud.
No, Arnaud.
Oh, Arnaud.
Arnaud he's a snappy dresser.
As you'd expect he would be.
Yeah.
Yes.
I'm in awe of him and
you
what
are.
He's built. Of Arnaud?
Yeah.
He picked off, what did he pick off, Tiffany? What did he get for nothing? She's a new line of Tiffany. It's so great.
That may have ended up being a good deal.
Well, that's why I went Black & Decker. Stanley Black & Decker. You guys raising prices.
What kind of saw did you buy?
It's just... Home Depot.
Those are dangerous, those saws. You got to be careful.
No, it's just a straight out.
Luxury has not done poorly post-pandemic.
Look at that.
A lot of that's going to be Asia, of course,
yes.
Where, once again, Jim, there's a lot of talk that the China trade is back on, outperforming the Russell again. We're no longer walking in here seeing crazy headlines every morning.
No, we'll talk to Henry Fernandez soon from MSCI, maybe shed some light on that, but even when in the Wynn conference call, now, of course, we know that Mr. Maddox is leaving, but
yes.
In the Wynn conference call, they're saying, look, the Macau authorities, business as usual. I mean, this is rather amazing. We know that high-end luxury, I mean, it was very interesting when I interviewed Fabrizio Freda, the fabulous CEO from Estee Lauder. The party, once clean skin, once they like skincare.
They encourage skincare.
Well, the party's not a, I don't want to be facetious here. It's middle class that is on, that is not under fire. And middle class buys Estee Lauder. So it's the ultra rich that are under fire. Okay, so let's distinguish. The party's not going after the middle class. It just hasn't.
Yep.
Which is smart. They got 400 million middle class.
We're going to be on the lookout for China Xi Biden headlines, maybe as early as tonight.
What do you think of that?
Yeah, we're going to find out a lot more tonight and Monday. As we go to break, take a look at bonds this morning as the Dow's up about 90. Interesting week all across the curve. 5-year week to date up 20 basis points. That's the biggest surge in about 2 years. 10-year, though, still around 156. We'll be right back. We were just talking about the recovering China trade, and in fact, Chinese stocks do dominate the list of this week's biggest gainers on the NDX. We'll talk more China with the chairman and CEO of MSCI in just a moment.
ESG in China, these are two huge trends in focus for investors that we talk about all the time. As the regulatory crackdown continues to weigh on Chinese stocks, U.S. negotiates a new climate deal with China at COP26. These are just the major issues of our day. And we have the person who knows more about this in terms of the empirical nature of what it does for stocks than anyone, MSCI Chairman CEO Henry Fernandez. He's joining us now to discuss it all. Henry, it is always great to see you. Thank you for joining us on Squawk on the Street.
Good to see you, Jim.
So Henry, I don't know whether people realize the role you play, but if you could probably give us the context, you really are the person who decides whether a country's, let's say, their entire market should be included in what turns out to be trillions of dollars that are trying to find out whether it should be in a diversified fund. Can you tell us the process you use?
To basically try to understand the needs and the requirements of global investors in making a market investable for them, and then go to the country and try to understand what is it that they have done in terms of regulatory environment and market access and investability and all of that. And so we go back and forth between the two, you know, pretty much primary participants here, the investors and the issuers, in the form of the country, and then you know, have a methodology and render a judgment basically as to whether the market is investable and it can be included in our indices or not.
Okay, so let's use the focus on the word investable. If a country's government has decided to turn some companies from profit to nonprofit, seems to be upset with some companies and how much money the CEOs have been making, of course, speaking about China, does that give you second thoughts or is that one off? And what can you do as the person who already decided that China should be a member of the Council of Nations when it comes to finance? Maybe they don't deserve that status.
Well, Jim, you know, a lot of what we do is In a big part of our business is define the investable universe of companies. You know, we don't know opine whether the company is going to be, you know, good profit making or not and the like. And therefore, we just try to create what is available for people to invest in and what is not available. So that is the what we call the market cap indices. We obviously have other indices that that narrow the scope. You know, in terms of ESG, for example, is this a company or a country that is following certain norms of investability, of environmental, you know, issues and ratings and all of that? So, but, you know, the market cap indices are the investable opportunity set. If the, you know, there is intervention, obviously, in a lot of countries, in a lot of companies, not just China. China is obviously a big example of it. But then these investors have to decide whether they want to overweight that company, not overweight it, or not even invest in it.
Understood. Now, we have a huge move, obviously, in ESG. I don't think people understand. Henry Fernandez actually does the tire kick in these situations. Henry, how can we be sure that companies really are deserving of a positive ESG status, given what you and I both know are companies that are trying to pretend that they're good for the environment?
Yeah, what we do in our ESG in general, and we can talk briefly about climate as well, but in ESG in general, we gather information, you know, on the companies from all sources. About 50% of the data that we gather is directly from companies, reports to Securities Commission or press releases or websites or whatever. The other 50% comes from independent sources like courts of law and environmental agencies, you know, and the like, in order to understand other aspects of their ESG criteria. And then we have a model that it is very scientific as to how much we weight each one of those areas, depending on the sector, the industry, and we create a rating. On climate itself, it's, climate is part of ESG, but it's also being, you know, broken out in its own. It's going to be an incredible amount of, needs for information and data and metrics on climate, especially coming out of COP26 in Glasgow.
Yeah. Henry, it's David. I mean, I can understand on governance, even diversity and inclusion, but when it comes to the environment, as you say, and climate and all the inputs, I don't know if I have confidence, even with that rigorous process you describe at this point, that you're really giving me an accurate reflection of what I can expect as I allocate capital and try to do it appropriately.
Well, first of all, that is the fundamental question. You know, a lot of investors around the world are not getting blind in terms of understanding the current carbon emissions of companies or any other issuer for that matter. And secondly, what are the projections of those companies in the next 5, 10, 20 years? So we at MSCI have developed metrics to be able to estimate the carbon emissions of about 10,000 publicly listed companies and 15,000 private companies. And on the publicly listed companies, we've gone beyond that. We've been able to estimate also the temperature alignment of those companies into the future, depending on the kind of temperature world we live in. Is it a 2-degree company, a 3-degree company, a 5-degree company, and the like? We have to also understand that there's a lot of data that we gather, but a lot of these are models into the future. The climate change problem is a go-forward problem. It's not only a current problem, and therefore there will be estimations. There will be accuracy in some aspects or lack of it in other aspects. But, you know, we cannot necessarily think that perfection in all of these tools and metrics will be appropriate. You know, the perfect plan will be the enemy of a good plan here.
Well, look, Henry, it's just great to have you on. Henry Fernandez, the CEO of MSCI. Great to see you, sir.
Thank you, Jim and David.
Yep, absolutely. Henry, I'll see you soon. Is like Larry Fink when it comes to a lot of stocks. You can determine, you can make or break different countries. That's one of the reasons why I think it's so important. And the ESG question you asked, we don't want greenwash.
It's also been a
magnificent performer, MSCI.
Yes.
And a lot of that is Henry's work. He did do China. He went to China many times to try to figure out whether the legitimacy of it. And it's very interesting.
Yeah. Big job. Interesting. And stock's been hitting a series of all-time highs pretty much all year long.
Yes, yes.
Tonight,
Duolingo, which a lot of people are using to be able to learn languages, does better than a lot of colleges. And then Nick Akins, I want to always get the largest electric transmission company. I want to find out the tenor of things in this country.
We look forward to a busy week for you next week.
Yes, and I will be on some Check. I'm thrilled to be with Deirdre Mosa and you on Check Tech, and I can't wait because it has been almost 2 years since I've been out on the coast, and it's where I learn everything. Try to go 4 times a year. Try to find out whether people are turning down Facebook in order to be able to work at a good tool and die company.
All right, just don't get lost in the metaverse.
I have Iceland. In the end, there's always Iceland.
Iceland's beautiful. That tourist thing worked for me.
Yeah.
I'm like, I'm going.
Right, let's go.
I'll send my digital twin over there. I don't want to go.
We'll see you tonight.
All right, thank you.
Jim Cramer, Mad Money, 6 p.m. Eastern Time.
You've been listening to the opening bell on CNBC's Squawk on the Street.